This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The pandemic has both underscored and exacerbated some serious long-term issues in the region, and that includes housing affordability.
Too many people have to spend too high a percentage of their income on housing and can lead to excessive debt, and too many people who just are struggling and not being able to get by and falling by the wayside. You know, the percentage of income people have to spend on their housing seems to keep going up and up.
Okay, so that's Olin Myers, who lives in Boston, where housing has become a key issue in the mayoral race. A recent poll sponsored by WBUR found that housing was second only to the pandemic as a priority for Boston voters in that upcoming election. The poll also found that 76% of voters support some form of rent control. So as we emerge from the pandemic, as we tackle these structural issues that were laid bare, can we make strides on housing affordability? We're going to look at that, and we're going to start by looking at Boston itself. Joining us to do that, Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards. Councilor, welcome back.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity.
So it's great to have you. I want to start by asking if you think housing affordability is one of these linchpin post-COVID issues, meaning if we can stabilize housing for people, address some of the affordability issues, does that allow us to then build on that for some of the other big systemic inequality that was laid bare during the pandemic?
Personally, I think housing is the issue. It's the issue that connects all other issues. It helps. If you have housing, it's harder to become sober. If you don't have housing, excuse me, if you don't have housing, it's harder for you to find a job. It's harder for your kids to go to school. It impacts their ability to learn. It impacts so many aspects of your life. If you do not have secure housing, studies have shown that children facing in homes that are rent burden and facing displacement, they test and demonstrate learning disabilities and stress levels of children who are homeless. So it impacts us at the granular level. And so I would call it less the linchpin. It is the issue. It's the issue.
So, when you lay it out that way, right, one can feel and hear that urgency. And during the pandemic, so many times, as we recognize the deep structural problems that were laid bare, we said never again. So do you think we have a moment of new will or particular opportunity in the city of Boston to address housing affordability? It is a gnarly, gnarly issue.
We do. We have, not only do we have new will, I think we have new perspective, and we also have new funds coming in. And I'm going to still hope that DC sends in, I think the American Jobs Policy to get those additional funds as well. But the fact is we have a lot of new energy to really tackle this. And so I see this as a moment and also a driving force within the mayoral conversation as well.
What are some of those things that you think we can get done with new energy and new funds?
Well, I mean, we'll start with what we're working on right now, but really being aggressive in pushing for increasing the linkage, which is the fee that developers pay for square footage to build commercial rates, increase that. It went up, it needs to keep going up. Really just defining our inclusionary development policy, the 13% is outdated, it doesn't work, and the fact is it's too high in terms of its affordability, and just changing that outright. And so we're working on that, and I have hearings scheduled to literally change that 13%. Advocates want 33%, and they definitely want a lower average income for that as well. Those are the
conversations. That's the linkage number, right?
Linkage again is for the per square foot that they pay out of pocket. So
right.
It went up to about $14, $15. It needs to be more. But for the just defining, if you go to build something, Mr. or Ms. Developer, right now we say 13% affordable, 70% AMI, which is the income-ish. Just make it $70,000 just for
yeah.
math purposes.
Yeah.
And I think it needs to be much higher in terms of the affordability, and it needs to be much lower in terms of what the average income could be to qualify for the affordability. That's where we have a disconnect right now. We're defining our housing success by how much we can build, but we're not defining it by who can actually live there. And I think
that's
the first thing we start to do.
So what that would do is broaden the net for people who can qualify for affordability supports, essentially. When you talk about, you know, broadening AMI, area median income, you've talked about raising some revenue through the linkage fee. Are there zoning changes? I mean, you worked on a zoning issue, for example. So let's talk about zoning and other policy changes. And again, this can seem like dry stuff, but this is where the rubber meets the road on whether people can stay in their homes, right?
Well, it's where the city's moral compass actually meets its planning is in zoning. And if and that's what we need to just be very honest. Zoning is how you say what we envision in our city, what we aspire to be. And we set rules for that so that developers, when they come in, they follow those rules. And this is, or they're supposed to. And so the zoning amendment I proposed, which is to affirmatively further for housing, which has been adopted and is now the in the zoning code, is pushing developers to have an eye towards equity and their projects to be judged on how more equitable they're making communities. That includes the affordability, that includes assessing if they're displacing people of color, that includes looking at whether they're actually inclusive of families. It includes whether you're making it a transit-oriented development. All of those things are about the access to opportunity, which is a standard that now developers are being held to.
So what can other communities learn from that? As we watch this play out in Boston, and obviously that will be fraught this year because there is a massive mayoral race underway. What can other communities who are watching learn from this?
Well, I think what we all need to learn is that this is, we need to stop with the whole narrative of somehow the market is going to fix this moment, right? The market is not going to house us. I'm sorry. I know that really bothers people when I say that, but the market is not going to house us. The market is going to make sure that the developers and the owners and those are making money. That's the market's job, that they make money, not that people are housed. So we need to, first of all, say housing is a human right. And our policy needs to reflect that. It needs to fund that. It's a right. It is assumed that you should have a place to live, some shelter, some dignified, sanitary place for all of us to live. And when you write policy from that grounding, from that moral standard, then that should be reflected in the zoning as well.
That's a perfect place to talk about where the rubber meets the road. This is going to be an ongoing conversation. We're going to talk about this a lot on Radio Boston. I'm sure we will talk with you about it again. Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards, thanks for joining us on this.
Thank you.
So that's the city view. Now let's look regionally. And to do that, we want to bring in Barry Bluestone, professor emeritus at Northeastern University, where he was founding dean of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs. Barry Bluestone, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
So I know you were listening to our conversation with Councillor Edwards there. Let me just start with a couple reactions from you to what you heard her say about where the imperatives are and where the rubber meets the road in housing affordability right now.
Well, I agree with Lydia in for the most part. Housing should be a right, and it's critical for the well-being of all our citizens. But I'd go further and to say that all of us should be concerned about making sure we have housing for everyone, because particularly in the greater Boston area, not just the city, but the suburbs, we're getting to a point where housing is so expensive that people no longer can afford to live here, particularly people who have, you know, traditional working class jobs. And in order to maintain the great economy we have in Boston, we need to find a way to make sure we have housing for everyone so that we don't lose workers. We already have a job shortage in many parts of the community, and we don't lose firms who start leaving the city because they can't find a labor force. Where I think we can make some real progress is something we've not done before. The city council mayors have always really pressured our universities and to some extent other institutions to help build housing. That's particularly true for our undergraduate students. But if you look at the demographics of Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, and the communities around us, what has really led to the explosion in home prices has been our success at attracting young graduate students, medical interns, residents, young people to work in biotech, high tech, and financial services. And of course, many of them are waiting a while longer to couple up two or three or four of them get together, as my son did, and rent a triple decker for twice what a working family can pay. So what I've been advocating for a number of years, in addition to zoning reform, in addition to expanding inclusionary zoning and making sure the developers are putting up affordable housing, is that for a new coalition led by the mayor of Boston, led by the governor, to go and sit down with the presidents of the major universities, sit down with the CEOs of the major medical institutions, sit down with the CEOs and presidents of the major biotech and financial service companies and say, look, the people you've hired, great, we're glad to have them here, but they've caused a major problem in housing. We need your help now. We want you at Northeastern College to work with developers to put up housing for those graduate students, for those medical interns and residents. Get them out of the old triple deckers that were originally built for working class families so that we can begin to have a supply of housing, some of it old, some of it new, that will meet demand and begin to soften prices in the market. I think
so. Greg Bluestone, let me take it back from you there. Yeah. So what I hear you proposing is new housing stock for a targeted group of people that come through universities in order to free the current housing stock for families, young and growing families who need that starter home and are being priced out of it now. Is that right?
Exactly.
How long would that take, Barry? Well, so let's say you got the universities together and they said, yep, we get it. We can do this coalition. How long till we see relief?
Well, I think we'd see, relief in 3 or 4 years, and then it would grow very rapidly after that. It's not the only thing we should be doing. We need to make sure that we're using some of the federal funds to build housing that people can afford. We need to increase Section 8 availability to families, which provides rent subsidies. We need to do all of that. But if we don't solve the supply problem, we're going to have the housing crisis for decades, if not longer.
Where's the hardest place to find will? So I hear you very clearly, and listeners should hear you, that we have got a supply problem we have to fix. Where do we need to do a full court press on the will to fix it?
Well, I think what we can begin to see is the business community coming forward and saying, this is a crisis for us. And we've had many, many people and community organizations, community development corporations, Lydia and her colleagues on the council, who have been making this case, but we need to get the business community out front to really move on this, because it's not only a question of equity and racial equality, it is a question of financial well-being for the community and for these firms. So I think we need to organize a broad-based coalition, which includes the business community, includes the unions, includes community organizations, to really fight for all the things that Lydia would like to see, plus the kind of housing supply we need to get from, with help from all of our major institutions.
So I want to play some sound for you here. WBUR's Simone Rios spoke to Boston resident Sherita Beck about the issue. She says she'd like to live in Nubian Square. It's where she works, where she grew up, but she can't because the prices are too high. Here she is.
And then they have the new building. I believe that's going to be apartments. And they're going to be not priced right. I'm definitely not looking to buy in Boston because it's high. Just like the rent, the mortgage.
So, that's Sherita Beck and that's Nubian Square, but she could be in any of a number of regional communities where the housing is too high. What happens to us, in a nutshell, briefly, if we don't fix this?
Well, I think your guest said it. I'm not going to live, I can't live in Boston. Question is where they go. I've been traveling around the country to other communities with booming economies like Raleigh, North Carolina, where housing is one half to one third of the cost here. We're going to lose out. When I first moved to Boston 50 years ago, Boston was in trouble. I was able to rent a one bedroom apartment in Back Bay for $204 a month. We're not a strong economy, but as the universities expanded, as financial services expanded, all of that happened, we had a Boston Renaissance. We now are in trouble because unless we can solve the housing crisis, that renaissance could come to an end as people like your guest decide that this is no longer a place they can afford to live and work and contribute to the economy.
All right, so we have to keep our eye on this ball. That is Barry Bluestone, Professor Emeritus at Northeastern University, where he was founding Dean of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
This is a bittersweet day to commemorate the departure, retirement of an all-time great, Danny Ainge, who won championships as a player and won a championship as a head of basketball, unprecedented in Celtics history. One of the truly finest people I've ever met in my life, on and off the court. You epitomize what it is to be a Celtic.
That is Boston Celtics co-owner Wick Grousbeck. He's speaking to reporters yesterday at a surprise press conference announcing that Danny Ainge would be stepping down as the president of basketball operations for the Celtics and head coach Brad Stevens would be taking his place. Now, understand, Danny Ainge was a former Boston Celtics player and in the front office role for 18 years. Brad Stevens just finished his coach during a pretty bad basketball year with a team full of talent that he couldn't get to act like a team. So yes, this is a really big deal on the basketball front. It's also a fascinating study in how any business or organization handles leadership, failures, changes, internal culture, disruption, all of it. So let's talk about it. Here to help us check the score, of course, is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Tiziana, that is the longest I've ever gone without interrupting you. I think I deserve a cookie for that.
You know, if I had a cookie, I would give it to you. Absolutely. Chocolate chip. And joining us for this also, Kyrie Thompson, sports writer for Boston.com. Kyrie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you a lot for having me.
It's great to have you. And listeners, we're welcoming your calls on this. If you follow basketball, what do you make of these Celtics moves? This is a really big deal. This is like if Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft made a change or made a swap, you know, like that at the Patriots. So if you've been following it, was leadership the problem for the team? What do you think of this? But even if you're not a hoops fan, raises some questions. If an organization is struggling with failure or its internal culture is off, what is the right step? Do you make a leadership change? Do you hold things in place and try to work on your team? What do you want to see happen in your own company if it's facing something like this? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Chris, Kyrie, that is kind of where we're going at this. There are some really interesting leadership lessons going on here. So Kyrie, I'm just going to start by asking you, how surprising was it to see a shakeup after this painful Celtics season?
It was very surprising. I think it took really the entire NBA community off guard. And it's interesting because there were musings about Danny Ainge and how long he wanted to stay in the job. And would he consider stepping down after some of the criticism he's gotten in recent years? And in particular this year, where, I mean, this team was one game away from going to the NBA finals.
Don't remind me. Come on.
Yeah. They were one game away from going to the finals. And then they ended up as the seventh seed this year in the East. And they were constantly like hovering around 500 and they like weren't beating teams they were supposed to beat. And so I think, you know, Ainge took that personally. You know, he said that he didn't feel like he had necessarily done the best job, but it didn't necessarily mean that all of us expected that he would hang it up. And certainly the idea of Brad Stevens not being the coach anymore. I mean, a lot of people wanted to blame Brad Stevens for how this year went. You know, there are obviously conflicting opinions on that, but I mean, this is a guy he's locked in, you know, contract wise for like the next 4 or 5 years. So it's like, no one expected him to go anywhere.
I do think the Stevens part is the most surprising, if you don't mind, Tiziana, because Ainge, you know, he's talked about since this announcement, he's had a couple of heart attacks over the last 10 years or so and was kind of concerned about stress level and all that. And as Kyrie said, there have been kind of rumblings that he may step away. But Stevens, there was talk of Brad Stevens getting fired during the year. There's a report out there that at least one prominent member of the Celtics front office wanted him to be fired as the coach this year. So to see him essentially get a promotion and is now running the whole show, I think that is the real surprising part of this news. He's got zero front office experience. It is stunning, I think, to see Stevens jump to that job.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, right? It's like he didn't have any NBA head coaching experience when he took over this job either. You know, when you think about it.
And it's true. And Danny Ainge jumped from coach to front office. So it's not like it can't be done. Yeah. I just think it's surprising to see it done this quickly.
And I listened to Danny Ainge talk about this, and he was pretty adamant that the whole rumor about Brad Stevens somebody wanting to fire him, that it was false and all that. But obviously you never know what really goes on behind the scenes. Of course he's going to say that. I just figured I'd put that out there, but yeah, I mean, this season was, I mean, you can't deny that this did not go the way that the Celtics planned or hoped.
Yeah.
So let's pick up on that thread, because now you guys have raised an important point that, again, I think anybody can understand. You have somebody whose job it is to produce a win, right? To produce a positive outcome. They don't. And then the next thing you know, they're promoted, right? This is an interesting thing. And we're going to come back to some parallels from some other big Boston institutions in a minute. But talk about where the systemic failures were inside the Celtics organization, because there are lessons there too for organizational culture that are bigger than basketball. So Chris, jump in there, and then Kyrie, round it out for us.
Yeah, to me, this is a journey that I think started a few years ago when the Celtics actually acquired Kyrie Irving. I think you really started to see a shift in this franchise's approach and values. The NBA for a long time now has been a player-driven league. Players have all the power. They decide where they play. Some of the best players decide who their coach is going to be. So it is a player-driven league. The Celtics have tried to kind of remain outside of that. They have this kind of storied history, 17 titles, the most titles in the history of the league. And they've kind of had this approach. The team is bigger than any one player. You don't see a lot of teams approaching it with that mindset anymore. And I think when Kyrie came here, he tried to bring the Celtics into this kind of modern NBA moment and tried to be this guy. And the Celtics, I think, gave him a lot of leeway. There was a moment where he played in an all-star game after missing the two actual regular season games before that. And Celtics front office said, oh, it's no big deal, whatever, we don't really care. So there was kind of this idea, we're going to let him be a little bit of me first, and hopefully that'll make him happy and he'll want to stay here and re-sign here. And I think in doing that, they've kind of sacrificed the values of the franchise. No, he didn't. And I think ultimately it's because they weren't willing to go far enough and do the type of things. Like I said, Kyrie's the kind of player, he wants to be able to have input on who the coach is. He wants to be able to have input on who's on the roster. And the Celtics weren't quite willing to give that much up. But they found themselves in this kind of no man land, I think, where they've now lost this idea of team first, but they're not fully in the player-driven moment either. And it's going to be really interesting to see where they go from here.
So Kyrie Thompson, we were just talking about player Kyrie Irving. Do you agree that we now have a basketball team, an institution that's kind of in a cultural no man's land where they don't know who they are and you can't bring the best out of your players? Because there are great players on this team, but they have not been able to function as a team. Do you agree with that diagnosis?
I would. And first of all, it's like I feel sometimes like I do have to apologize for my name in advance around here. It's like, oh, you're Kyrie too.
Not
like,
that Kyrie.
Hey, I didn't pick that one. I think it's really interesting that you brought up obviously Kyrie Irving and that being a starting point, because then think about what happened in, you know, that 2017-2018 season. You know, Kyrie Irving is there, Gordon Hayward is there, and they have this big four, you know, kind of that they're working on. And then all of a sudden, Gordon Hayward gets hurt right away. Kyrie Irving,
and he was a promising and exciting draft pick, right? Just for our listeners.
Yeah. Well, they brought him in from Utah, but yeah, he was a really talented scorer, great player.
Yeah. And go so ahead. They, yeah. this big four kind of like player driven plan that you talked about didn't work. And they went to the NBA finals, or they almost made it to the NBA finals. Anyway, they were a LeBron James away from getting there. But it's like, that was an example of almost like the inverse, the team first. We're going to grind. We're going to get everything out of this squad that we have. And they almost made it to a title opportunity. It was an incredible thing to watch when you had two young players in Jason Tatum, who was a rookie, and Jaylen Brown, who was a second year player, running this thing. And then when you fast forward that now a couple of years, I do think they're in a bit of a no man's land kind of crossroads, because now you've had a situation where they tried to get like another big three with Kemba Walker, who's been, he's a very good vibes kind of guy, good team first guy, but he hasn't been healthy. So he hasn't been contributing into this necessarily like a real big three on a consistent basis. And then you have you know, now these two all-star players who are great that are almost sometimes playing one or two on five out there. And then the defense wasn't as good this year as it's been in years past. And it really makes you think, it like, did they need a change of leadership from the coaching staff? Were they listening, right? Did they buy in fully? And was it time to make this change? Because they just kind of ran out of room here in the window for this particular partnership with Brad Stevens as the coach and this core as the star. Did it run out? I think that it did. And I mean, you never plan on it going that way, but certainly I think that the Celtics have much bigger questions to answer than just who the coach is going to be going into next year.
So what does that then, again, we always cross over when we do sports here on Radio Boston, we kind of always cross over between the sports and sort of how it signifies in the larger world. And I find myself hearing this and I think, okay, you've laid all that out. It's clear to see that where the failures, the structural or the institutional failures have been. And now you see the coach promote up, right? So the team, the fans, everybody see that you've got this coach who now is permanent and an even bigger and arguably more important role. How do you then turn around a team with that kind of hanging out over the heads, Chris? How do you, what does the organization do now?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, and we'll see is the real answer here. But I think there's a couple of things in what you just said. Brad Stevens, I don't know that this is a permanent move, to be honest. He is young. I could see him in a year or two getting the itch to try to get back into coaching here or elsewhere. But I do think the Celtics organization clearly loves the way Brad Stevens sees the game. They think he has a great tactical basketball mind. Where he failed as a coach was his ability to connect with players, especially young superstars. And so much of coaching in the NBA is about just managing your talent and making sure all your guys are happy and have what they need to be successful. And that's, I think, why we saw Stevens do better with some of these lesser known, less talented, frankly, guys than he did once Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown started to emerge into the stars that they're going to be over the next few years. All I'll say is this is a huge window for this team. We've got Jason Tatum for three more years, and who knows what happens after that. So they really need to maximize this moment over the next year or two.
So Kyrie, you know, I this is reminiscent for me of Marty Walsh knows he's leaving. So just before he leaves, he appoints a new police commissioner without vetting. Now, obviously, from there, we go some very different places. But Brad Stevens gets put in for Danny Ainge because he's the guy they know and they think he can do it. So how important is it now to have a real search process for the coach? And what do we have to look for in that process?
Well, I'll tell you what, like, this decision is the biggest one the Celtics franchise probably has had to make for quite a long time. Maybe not every last thing hinges upon it, but most of the stuff that follows will depend on this. And one thing that I'm seeing is that is that they're not necessarily looking for a coach to come in with brilliant X's and O's knowledge who, you know, draws up the perfect plays and puts everybody in the perfect spots on the court and all of that. I mean, Brad Stevens can do that. Brad Stevens can be part of that process. It seems like what they want is somebody who is going to buy into this culture, who is going to instill a toughness, who's going to spark these guys and inspire them to get back to where they were just, you know, a couple of years ago, or honestly, a couple of months ago, to be honest with you. And I think that there's such a wide net potentially being cast right now. You see a bunch of big names, you know, former coaches. You're also seeing some guys from the college ranks that were former NBA players that are known to have a lot of that fire. Like I've seen, you know, like a Juwan Howard who, you know, he actually almost got into it with somebody during the NCAA tournament and fired up his team and they loved it and all that. I'm also seeing the possibility of maybe the Celtics take a good hard look at hiring the first female head coach in NBA history.
There you go.
I've seen the name Becky Hammon, an assistant for the San Antonio Spurs, who's a great WNBA player, well-respected. She's been in the Spurs organization learning from one of the best ever over there. And she's been a hot name for a few years. It just kind of depends on who, you know, maybe decides to take that chance. I've also seen Carol Lawson.
All right,
I got to take it back from you there.
Let's say, I just want to say, Bruins game 3 tonight, 7:30. You know I'm on this team. This is a cup contender. Check it out. Series heads back to New York. It's going to be a good one. There's my music. All right, go Bees. We can do it.
Hey, great to have you both. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break here. I'm Tiziana Deering. When we come back, vaccine incentives. We're going to talk about them. This is Radio Boston. We're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about vaccine incentives. They are controversial. It's fascinating because it pits the push to get shots into arms against the idea that people should want to get a shot in their arm. Here's President Biden announcing one vaccine incentive program from Anheuser-Busch, maker of Budweiser.
And to top it off, Anheuser-Busch announced that beer is on them on July the 4th. That's right. Get a shot and have a beer. Free beer for everyone 21 years or over to celebrate the independence from the virus.
Now, Massachusetts ranks near the very top for percentage of adults vaccinated, and even we have jumped into the incentives game, funding $25 market basket gift cards, reportedly exploring using the state lottery. So we want to unpack this. There are questions that range from ethics to efficacy. We've got a great team helping us do that. Dr. Ashish Jha, health policy researcher and dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, and Michael Curry, president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, also a member of the NAACP's board of directors. Dr. Jha, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Michael, welcome back to you too.
Glad to be here.
And listeners, we welcome your thoughts. We would like to know, if you have not gotten a vaccine, would a lottery ticket or a cash incentive or even a $25 market basket gift card change your mind and get you to take that shot? Or are you someone who already got a vaccine and is frustrated that we might essentially pay other people to do the same thing you were willing to do on your own? We'd like to hear from you. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, Michael, Dr. Jha, there's several layers to this conversation. Let's just start with the should, because that really seems to be a big part of the issue. Should we incentivize, pay, to reward people for getting a vaccine that keeps not only themselves, but other people safe? Michael, what do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, one, I tend to be of the belief that whatever works. And I just want to start by saying, Dr. Jha, I thank you for your solid voice throughout this pandemic. I've lifted your name up and pointed to your direction throughout this pandemic. I worry about the gimmicky part of this. We know in the healthcare space, as I represent many of the primary care providers in the community health centers across the state, as we're dealing with diabetes and heart disease and cancer and HIV/AIDS, that you can do the gimmicky stuff and it'll help draw some people in. But whether it's sustainable, and in this case, if you get them in for one shot, can you get them back in for a second shot? Can you get them back in for a booster shot? Can you get them back in for an annual shot if we're at that point of a COVID-19 annual shot? That's the real hard work, is how do you get them the information around the efficacy and safety of these vaccines in a way that they get it? And it's not a ticket or a lottery ticket or a gun or a beer that drives them to get a vaccine.
All of which are incentives at different states. So just so people don't think you made a random list there, all of which are incentives that different states are offering. So Dr. Jha, Michael's, saying there, ultimately people have got to want to do it. What are your thoughts? We're in this should space. Should we incentivize as the vaccines trail off and we're still really not at 50% around the country of people vaccinated?
Yeah. And Michael, thank you for your comments. And I agree largely with them. I mean, first and foremost, I would say whatever it takes at this moment, and we should think about what does it take for a small portion of people. It is, the incentives are going to help. We know that empirically. We've seen it in Ohio when they put in their lottery, they saw a bump in people getting vaccinated. Other states have put in incentives, even ones that feel a little gimmicky. It has a short-term bump. For other people, the real incentive, the real thing that's going to get them there is someone who they trust asking them to get the vaccine, telling them that they should get the vaccine. And this is where places like community health centers, to be perfectly honest, play a massive role. You know, when I look at data, for instance, from Springfield, Massachusetts, that's a city with very low vaccination rates compared to the rest of the Commonwealth. Maybe, you know, lotteries will help there. I'm fine if it does. But what we probably really need to be doing is working with community organizations that know those members of the community, know what's going to move them, know how to build trust, and use that to drive vaccinations. We haven't spent enough time doing that. It's much harder than having a lottery, but I think in the long run, it's much more sustainable.
So I'm going to come back to you in a second, Dr. Jha, but you listening out there, we are a community. We are relying on each other to get vaccinated, to be safe as a community. How do you feel about our public policy choice to use incentives to get shots in more arms? 800-423-8255. Dr. Jha, there was an article in the New York Times, George Lowenstein, who's an economist at Carnegie Mellon University, and Cynthia Kreider, who's a marketing professor at WashU, Washington University, saying, quote, humans don't respond to incentives like rats pressing levers for food. They try to interpret what being offered payment means. In this case, the offer risks implying that the vaccine is not a thing of value, end quote. So basically, we got to pay you because it's not inherently valuable. What do you think of that argument, that that's a bad thing for that reason?
Yeah, no, I understand that. And there's this whole kind of behavioral economics part of like internal versus external motivations. You know, I try to be kind of empirical about this. Like, I wasn't sure if the lotteries were going to do much. And they did move some people. That's what the empirical evidence says. And so my take is, given how incredibly important it is for our society to get this virus under control, if it moves people, I think it's fine. Most of us got vaccinated because we saw an incredible value of getting vaccinated. I would have paid to get vaccinated. I was happy that it was free, but I think many of us would have. But for other people, they have other issues in their lives that feel more pressing, more complicated. And if for those people an incentive moves them, I think it's fine. I think we should do whatever is going to help people get there.
Michael, I want to offer you a chance to build on that.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Tiziana. I make the comparison to church, right? We used to say in church that we don't really care why people came to church. Maybe you were looking for a husband or a wife, and then you sat in the pews and you found God. So in the end, it was all worth it. But, you know, that may be true. But the problem is when you advertise, come find a man or a woman at church, right? And I think part of this is that we run into this dilemma where we're using gimmicks to draw people in, and whether that's Daytona 500 and tickets to Daytona 500 or these large lottery winnings or even scholarships, which I think is kind of interesting to draw in some students, these younger voters, younger persons who may not get a vaccine. But it concerns me. I think ultimately the hard work is what we often avoid doing. And that's the real on the ground, local public health department, community health center, community activists, community organizers, community health workers. That's the real work that's sustainable. And I just hope that we don't lose sight of that. And we invest in those people that Dr. Jha talked about, who they listen to, who they trust. And we don't try to circumvent that by trying to draw in people with cash winnings. It works in some cases, like the church analogy. But in the long term, I'm not convinced that it'll get us to a better place.
I'm going to grab a quick call, 800-423-8255. Molly's on the line in Cambridge. Hi, Molly, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if there are historical precedents of people resisting vaccines, like, for example, for polio or when flu was introduced, or is this a new phenomenon?
Thank you for that, Molly. Dr. Jha, I know we're going to actually have to say goodbye to you in a couple of minutes, so let me turn to you to answer that and give us your last reflections.
Yeah. So the issue of the sort of hesitancy, anti-vaccine sentiments, it's been around since the early days of the first time we started developing vaccines for smallpox. It's shown up every single time we have a vaccine. There's a group of people, even the misinformation is often the same. You know, you've all heard of misinformation about fertility and other things. These are the same stories that get trotted out over and over again after every new vaccine. So this, vaccines have been around for a couple hundred years, and the misinformation about vaccines have been around for just as long. And, you know, in terms of like final reflections, it may feel like Michael and I are maybe disagreeing. I actually think that the key point people need to understand is these incentives, they have marginal effects. And, you know, reasonable people can disagree on whether you should do them or not do them, but they should not be confused for the real effect that comes from working with people who understand communities where vaccine levels are low. And what I worry about, again, I've been pretty pro, you know, vaccine incentives, but what I worry about is that people will see that as a shortcut to our way home. And it's not. It's going to give us a couple of steps. Fine, I'll take it. But the hard work is these community-based organizations. We're seeing in places like Chelsea, where there are these incredible organizations doing amazing work, getting vaccines out to people. It's getting people vaccinated. That's what we need to see around the state and around the country. And I worry that we're looking for shortcuts to a much harder question.
So Dr. Jha, I know you carved out time you didn't have to join us. So I want to thank you, Dr. Ashish Jha, health policy researcher and dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. We'll say goodbye to you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Curry, thanks for staying with us. I'm actually going to go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255. Marjorie's on the line from Pepperell, Massachusetts. Marjorie, go ahead.
Hi. I don't believe that these incentives are going to work. I kind of feel like it's not fair. I've been working in healthcare for 11 years and got my last second dose of vaccine in the end of January. And it's like, I feel like, you know, what about all of us in healthcare that haven't got any of these incentives, except for, yay, you got your vaccine. But it's just, I feel like there needs to be more research into an individual that doesn't want to get a vaccine. Maybe they're just, that's their prerogative. They don't want to get the vaccine. I mean, I okay. hemmed and hawed, but I believed in science, and I went and got my vaccine.
Marjorie, thank you. Thank you for the call. Thank you for the example. Michael, I'm going to come back to you. You know, a recent Morning Consult poll found that 57% of unvaccinated adults said that a $1,000 savings bond would get them to get a shot. 43% said $50 would do it. So we know that at least for some, there is an incentive to get a shot. What Marjorie's talking about, Michael, is biblical, right? This goes all the way back to the prodigal son story where, you know, one son stays on the farm and does the work. The other one goes out, spends the inheritance, and then comes back and is forgiven and brought back into the fold. Now, I'm overstating it, but these are archetypal moments we're in. How do we think about that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we know that if you play on the needs and wants of people, there is an incentive in that. So if you're talking about someone who can't afford to feed themselves and you say, hey, we're going to give you food vouchers to come in and get a vaccine, of course, they're going to come in and get a vaccine. Not all of them, but many of them will. If you say to those Republican conservative white males in Wyoming, we're going to give you tickets to the Daytona 500, maybe that works with some of those men. And we know that there's a resistance within those conservative Republican circles of white men who deny that either the disease is as impactful as it has been or that a vaccine is as effective, right? So I think that, again, TC, I think the critical work is to go into those conservative spaces, to go into those immigrant communities, to go into those urban settings, to engage them on the issues and all the fake news that they've heard online around these vaccines and engage them on the truth. That takes more time, it takes relationships, it takes speaking to people in their culture, their language. And quite frankly, to the caller's point, I think that there are some people who will be drawn in by these incentives, but I just believe that that's the lazy way out. No discredit to President Biden and to Wyoming, West Virginia, Ohio, Illinois is considering it, Massachusetts, you know, The real work is working with us as community health centers and hospitals and in advocacy organizations, civil rights organizations. That's where most of us will get the information if you provide us with the resources to do it.
And I just want to point out, you're not just making it up. We've reported survey data in the past here on Radio Boston that there is a significant contingent of white and religious and conservative Americans who are resistant to getting a vaccine. So that's coming out of the data, just as we've had some data here in the Commonwealth that show that groups who are underrepresented are Hispanic residents, Black residents, and rural white residents in the western and southeastern parts of the state. So that's where that's coming from.
And Tiziana,
you know,
I think that
the
gun incentive is part of that, right? The Daytona 500, because the theme plays out there that they're trying to reach a certain demographic.
You know, in disaster response work, Michael, there are stages. And the first stage, the loose term for it would be, you know, sort of a stabilization. It's a triage stage, right? We gotta stabilize, make sure that people have their basic needs, and then we can work on rebuilding and reconstructing. I wonder if what we're not talking about here is kind of a multi-stage process where there is incentivizing to get enough people vaccinated with that first shot to stabilize us, right? To get us to some kind of baseline, and then work on education, desire, the reason for doing it, et cetera. Is that not a bad way to go? I mean, maybe that's a good way to do it.
You know, it's so funny. My kids know me as saying the answer is E, right? On everything we talk about, right? The answer is E. It can be all of the above, but I just think we have to make sure that we weight our efforts properly, right? To Dr. Jha's point, it's a tool, but it's not the tool. So yes, it could be what drives me in if I'm food insecure or transportation insecure or, you know, whatever that is, or I want to go to the Daytona 500, or I want to have a big lottery winning. It may draw me in to get that first shot. But we know from the data, these things have a short shelf life, and I may not come back in to get the care, right? I may not come back in to get the second shot or the booster shot. That is the concern, right? Is this is not a disease that's gone tomorrow. We will be still dealing with this disease in the fall and potentially into the future. And we're going to have longer term strategies that work. Maybe it gets us just a little further down the road towards herd immunity in the short term.
I'm going to try to pick up a call here. David's on the line on the Mass Pike in his car. David, go ahead.
So I'm as a physician and a citizen, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. I think it's our moral patriotic duty to be vaccinated. It was our moral patriotic duty to wear masks when we were endangering others. The incentive should be that's what Americans do. People before us had much, much bigger sacrifices than we have wearing masks and getting vaccinated. It's our patriotic duty.
David, thank you for that. Michael, we've got about a minute left. And this, David just brought us full circle, right? We started in the should space with this conversation, and then we talked about types of incentives, and we talked about whether they work and how they work. Is there something to, we need to find a way to connect our hearts and show up for each other and how we go after that?
Well, Tiziana, you and I have talked on many issues over the years, but I'm going to say, you know, just like we say, a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we see that play out with George Floyd, right? We want people to connect to that incident and those other incidents so that they weigh in on the justice, racial justice issue. The same is true in public health. A threat to public health anywhere in Africa, in India, is a threat to public health in the United States. So we have to now connect ourselves in this global way to understand that we need to invest in emergency preparedness. We need to be not defunding our pandemic response. Otherwise, we'll be here again. There'll be this disease or a new disease, and it'll take lives. So I think he is right. We can make this American, but we have a lot of work to do.
That is Michael Curry, president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, a member of the NAACP's board of directors. Always a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.